That's the end of the first half. As the teams head to the locker room, the Spartans lead the Bulldogs by a score.
You guys stink.
Jeez, Coach, we're only down a couple of points.
No, I mean you guys really smell. You need to hit the showers. And here, I got every one of you new bars of soap from the Sterling Soap Company. Each bar is artisan crafted using natural ingredients and essential oils. They also have shave soaps, colognes, beard balm, and a whole lot more. Now get in there.
But Coach, we have another half to play.
I don't care. I can't stand to be around you.
A few minutes later.
All right, bring it in tight. You guys are still playing terrible, but you're smelling great out there. Now listen, you're going to need to stock up for the rest of the season. We got a lot of tough games left. So go to sterlingsoap.com after the game. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com. You got that?
Yes, Coach.
Great. sterlingsoap.com on three. One, two, three.
sterlingsoap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, old sports, and welcome to the Hello, Old Sports podcast on the Sports History Network. It is midsummer. It's hot in Maryland, and I assume, Andrew, it is also hot in Connecticut. So what better time to travel back to a NFL game that was played in such cold weather that it had to be moved indoors to a hockey arena? How are you tonight?
I'm good. It's actually not that hot here. We're lucky. I was in Orlando last week and we had mild weather for Orlando in July and it was crazy hot here. And then right as we came home, it got to be like 100 in Florida and it's been in the low 80s since we returned. So I've played this successfully the last few days, but it is not as cold as it was in Chicago in December of 1932. That's for sure.
So one of the things that I wanted to kind of, you know, get into on the podcast over the next, you know, year or two with, you know, to, you know, obviously mixed in with a lot of other things is we've done some episodes on the early days of basketball, whether it was talking about rival leagues or just about a month ago, we did something on the 1950 NBA season. We did on 1950 in general, but obviously the NBA season was a part of that. And we've done a ton on 19th century baseball, probably a half dozen or so episodes at this point. We haven't done a heck of a lot really on early NFL football, some, but not, you know, not an excessive amount. So I thought it would be kind of cool to travel back to the very first NFL title game, and it was not not even really a title game, and we'll get into that a little bit as well. But in 1932, the Chicago Bears took on the Portsmouth Spartans in Chicago Stadium on, and I will get you the exact date here in a second. I believe it was on or about November 27th, but I will. Oh no, it was much later than that. I'm sorry.
It was in December. Yeah.
December 18th, 1932, for the very first NFL title game, and it was an interesting affair.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of this will be about the game. When I say the game itself, I don't even really mean the game itself. We're not going to go tons and like, oh, and then this team got a first down. First of all, I don't know if there was a first down in the game. Second of all, you know, but I mean like the situation surrounding the game itself, but what it also is a snapshot of, while what happened in this game and the necessity to play this game was a bit of an outlier, it's a good snapshot of the NFL in its very formative years. And you know, maybe towards the end, we can sort of put it in perspective, but you could almost argue that this ends the very earliest stage of the NFL, the first 10 or 12 years of, yeah, I know it was the AFPA for a couple of years, but like the first 10 or 12 years where it's like truly, you know, just a fly by night league. And then, you know, from the mid 30s, let's say until World War II, it's that much more focused. So this could sort of be seen as a turning point, you know, but sort of the lead up to it will give us a good illustration of what constituted professional football in 1932 and, you know, in the decade preceding that.
So there are a lot of people, you know, we are proud members of the Sports History Network and, you know, lots of podcasts on this network covering lots of different parts of sports history, but it is particularly strong in the football realm, you know, founded by Arnie, the football history dude. And, you know, guys like, you know, Darren and George Bazika, you know, they have football history podcasts. So we, you know, we sort of in some ways are a little bit sort of a little bit, you know, not the experts on the Sports History Network about early professional football, but maybe it would be good to just kind of set the stage a little bit. You know, professional football, quote unquote, had been around, I don't know, probably for a decent part of the 20th century. There were teams that won. Darren, in fact, wrote a book about the team in the very early 20th century that was the professional football champion of the world, of 1903 or 1904 or something. It sort of kind of begins to stabilize in the teens. The professional game is really centered around the Midwest, particularly Illinois, Ohio, Western New York, sort of the Buffalo, Rochester area. And in 1920, the NFL, what becomes known as the NFL, is formed in Canton, Ohio by Jim Thorpe and some others. It is known its first few years as the APFA, the American Professional Football Association. And you've got teams, you know, you've got your Chicagos and your Detroits and your Cleveland, but you've also got the Muncie Flyers and the Dayton Triangles and the Buffalo All-Americans. You got teams that are, you know, that never play at home, like the Rock Island Independents. It's really sort of a fly-by-night thing. And it kind of stays that way through most of the 20s and early 30s. You know, the champions, by and large, not entirely, but are teams you would hear of later, the Bears, the Packers. But then you also got the Pottsville Maroons and the Providence Steamroller. And that is sort of what the NFL is in the 1920s and into the 1930s.
And you mentioned the Dayton Triangles. I believe before that they were actually the Dayton Rectangles, but the next year they had to sell off an angle because they were losing money. But so professional football in the way that you're like professional, the word is best understood as just meaning sort of independent from college football. You know, there's no money, so to speak. There might be money, you know, they would certainly be open to being paid, but there's not like, you know, there's not any salaries really, or you know, anything significant.
Yeah, I think some of the guys got paid. You had a contract, but you're right. It was much more, you know, guys would jump teams, guy would do this. It kind of reminds me, I think probably the closest analog is the early days of Negro League baseball, like 20s and 30s, same time period, basically.
Yeah. So, and even in the early days of the NFL, and the way you can tell, and this comes up a little bit with this 1932 season, is that nobody plays a set number of games. And it's not just because teams fold, although that does happen with pretty regular frequency about halfway through the year, a lot of times or even less. But there's teams who either are refusing to play. Basically, the league isn't recognizable as what we consider a modern league until you get to a point where the league tells you this is your schedule, this is who you're playing. You're playing this many games at home, you're playing this many games on the road. When it's still sort of up to the teams, it's still sort of in its primitive stages. But you're right. It's a lot of teams in small markets. I mean, again, you have your the Giants, although the Giants for a long time are really the only major Eastern team. You have the Bears and the Packers, but like there's a lot, like you said, there's a lot of teams that are sort of transient or even teams that were good for their time that have been forgotten to memory, you know, by the time the 50s rolled around, let alone by the time the 2020s rolled around.
So just to give you an idea of a couple of different things here, the the champions, and this is all just, you know, quote unquote pennant races. There's no championship game, and this is who it is. It's the Akron Pros, Chicago Staleys, two in a row for the Canton Bulldogs, and then one in 1924 for the Cleveland Bulldogs, who were sort of kind of the predecessor to the Canton Bulldogs and kind of sort of not. 25, it's the Chicago Cardinals, but that's a dispute that has remained whether it truly should have been them or the Pottsville Maroons, and there were some questions of amateurism or lack thereof.
Fully 80% of the people who care about that do shows on this network.
the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets win in 1926. They're sort of, people consider them maybe the precursor to the Philadelphia Eagles, but I don't think that the NFL recognizes them as such. 1927, the first championship for the New York Giants. 28, the Providence, Rhode Island Steamroller. That is the last now defunct NFL team to win an NFL championship. And then from 29 to 31, you've got the Green Bay Packers, including an undefeated season, a 12-0-1 season in 1929, and two more championships in 30 and 31, led by guys like Johnny Blood McNally and Tony Canadeo, and coached by Curly Lambeau, the original great Packer teams. And I want to talk a little bit briefly about the 31 season in a second. But that going into the 1932 season is who the teams are. And go ahead.
Yeah, and I want to. So four of the first six championships were disputed to some degree. In the AFPA, APFA / NFL. The one that's referenced most prominently in the Wikipedia article about this 32 game we're going to talk about is the 1921 championship controversy. And again, controversy seems a little strong given the number of people who I guess controversy is better than scandal, but it was called the Staley Swindle among Buffalo sports historians. And there's some tie-ins to what we're going to talk about here, but basically, back then, obviously incredibly low scoring games, 0-0 very commonly, lots of ties. And the NFL, I think until the mid 70s, the way they would do ties basically got lopped off of your record. So if you were 10-1 and if you were 10-1-1, it was basically you were considered to be 10-1, which would be better than a team who was 11, whatever, if there was multiple ties.
To give it an extreme example, let's say in a 10-game season, you were better off being 2-0-8 than being 6-3-1. And I guess theoretically, if you won one game and tied the rest, that was considered an undefeated 1,000% winning percentage. And it's funny that they did it that way in those days because there was so much less scoring and so many more ties. So, you'd think that they would have felt, since there were so many damn ties, you'd think they would have thought of a better or found a better way to deal with it.
So basically in this 21 thing, it was the Chicago Staleys and the Buffalo All-Americans were the two teams that were in contention for this. And since the matter at hand is a decade later, it was very controversial where and you can tell because it's like it gets confusing because like half the guys have committed to play for other teams in other games. But through this whole thing, they're supposed to play a game that's considered like an exhibition. But Chicago wins. Buffalo basically goes out of their way and says this has nothing to do with the championship. Chicago wins. Halas is able to exert his influence to basically get that game to, while it doesn't count, to be considered as counting, and therefore like they're able to claim the championship and everybody kind of agrees that they have the claim to it. So after that, what the NFL does is they outlaw postseason games of this kind, and they institute a rule that's very – I'd never heard of this before, which is essentially if two teams play and they, let's say, the Giants and the Eagles play and the Giants win one and the Eagles win one and they finish tied at the end of the year, the game that's played later carries the weight.
Oh, jeez.
So that's the reason that's going to mean a lot in this thing and why they weren't able to break the tie. But so basically if they both finished, 9-1 and they both lost to each other, but the Eagles win had come in September and the Giants win had come in November, that's the tiebreaker, whoever won later in the season. So that was sort of the going rate of things post that 1921 controversy until the season we're about to talk about in 1932.
So let's fast forward to 1932, and I'll just give you the roster of who the teams were. And despite Andrew saying that the Giants were the only major team on the East Coast, by 1932, there's actually three teams playing in New York City. There's the Staten Island Stapletons in their final season. We talked about them a couple months ago, and we talked about Ken Strong and how he played there. The Brooklyn Dodgers, the New York Giants, there's the two Chicago teams, the Bears and the Cardinals, the Boston Braves, the Green Bay Packers, three-time champions, and the Portsmouth, Ohio Spartans. So it is kind of funny that even by 32, it really is all big cities other than Green Bay. And I mean, it's hard to sneeze at Green Bay because they're still there now. But like the Portsmouth, Ohio Spartans are kind of the last of the small town teams that would soon go extinct.
Yeah, I mean, depending on what you consider Staten Island, I mean, I know it's technically New York City, but they're not the New York Steamroller. They're the Staten Island Steamroller. But yeah, your point is well taken. By now, it's the NFL even of 1932 is a lot different than the NFL of 1926.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So we really want to concentrate on three teams here. It's the Bears, it's the Packers, and it's the Portsmouth Spartans. And it is worth noting that in their 1931 championship season, and this gets to the point that Andrew was getting at before, late in the season, and I just want to see if I can find the page number in the book that I was looking at, but nonetheless, late in the season, Green Bay, worried about playing Portsmouth, this is late in the 31 season, worrying about what that's going to do to their chances at first place, just refuses to play them. They just refuse to play the Portsmouth Spartans, and that helps God sort of usher in Green Bay's third ever championship.
Yep. Yeah. And that's, I have an article that references that heavily when we talk about the actual 32, that those teams playing in 32. So they weren't scheduled to play each other like earlier in the year. They were both 7-0-0. In week 8, the Spartans played two games on the weekend of October 31st. They beat Frankfurt, and then they went to the Polo Grounds and lost to the Giants. Packers beat the Bears. Portsmouth lost again the following week. Packers lost the week after that. But basically, they refused to. It's almost like putting a title on the line in like boxing or something like that. So that, it's seen as a bit of a low move, but also kind of like, well, they had the right to do that. And that again sort of shows just how still sort of a bush league it was that you could like do that and get away with it.
There's an author named Matthew Sherry who's written a book. It's called Any Given Sunday, and it's about the 20 games that kind of define the history of the NFL. And it's got the greatest game ever played in 1958. It's got the first Super Bowl. It's got the Ice Bowl. It's got the Giants' defeat of the Patriots in Super Bowl 42. Doug Williams, first black quarterback. Those types of things. And it has a chapter on this game, and this is how he describes it. The previous year, the Spartans went 5-6-3 in year one. They shocked the football world by being 11-3 the next year and were robbed of a chance to win it all by the continued farce of NFL scheduling.
Yeah, and this article I have talks about it where the decision was announced following a contentious 3-hour meeting with Harry Snyder, the Spartan business owner, Packers officials, and Joe Carr, the league president. Harry Snyder telegraphed the news to sports editor at the Portsmouth Daily Time. just concluded about 3 hours conference with the Green Bay officials and Joe Carr. Green Bay refuses to jeopardize its league standing by playing Portsmouth. They would give us no answer until after the Chicago game. So they wouldn't say whether they were going to play until they found out whether they would need to play. Like, suppose, I guess, presumably if they had already clinched the conference or the league, they would have come and played because it wouldn't have hurt them. But since they lost.
By 1932, the first 13 seasons of this league, is that the right, I guess counting 32. Anyway, in the first 13 seasons, here's the stat I have. In the first 13 seasons, five times out of 13, the team with the highest winning percentage had fewer wins than the team that finished in second place. So, yeah. And so maybe this is a little bit of a, an effort to start getting at that issue. On November 25th, the Packers, Bears, and Spartans all have a chance to win the championship. But then I believe, and if you give me a second, I will verify this, but I believe in a late season game, the Spartans defeat the the Spartans defeat the Packers late in the season. Yeah, on the fourth, on the very last regular season game, the Spartans defeat the Green Bay Packers 19-0. I believe that that win would have given Green Bay the title. Let me pull up the standings here. And it's confusing because this other game counts as part of it. But so at the end of the first, you know, the Bears are 6-1-6, the Packers are 10-3-1, and the Spartans are 6-1-4. So the Bears and Spartans are both 6-1 in wins. Had the Packers won that game, they would have been 11-2, which I think 11-2 is a higher 11-2 is higher than 6-1, I believe. I believe had the Packers, and if you give me a second, I might be able to find that, but I believe if the Packers had won that game in the very last game of the season against Portsmouth, they would have been the champions.
Right. We could probably talk more about the two individual teams that played in the championship to sort of set the stage for the game. But I have a big article about this game, the Packers against Portsmouth in this game.
Go ahead.
So they played in week one of the season. The Packers had beaten the Spartans at Green Bay at Lambeau Field. Playing in Green Bay, Lambeau's men. So I got confused. Playing in Green Bay, Curly Lambeau's Packers. They win 15-0. It's the last game of the season. Packers travel to Portsmouth to face off against the Spartans. Potsy Clark, who's the Spartans coach, and to show you sort of the time frame, he originally made his name as a coach coaching football in World War I.
Exactly.
It's an interesting time back in the days when, like, that was an acceptable thing you could do during the war when you're in the military. It's like, what did you do in the army during the Great War? I coached football. But anyway, he was drilling his 17 Ironmen hard this week. And with his scoring aces, Dutch Clark, Glenn Presnell, and Gutkowski, Grid fans will feel football at its zenith. This game is known as the Ironman game. And do you know why it's called the Ironman game?
I do not.
It's called the Ironman game because the Portsmouth Spartans, and for it to be known as this, this was rare even for the time. Guess that?
Did they have no subs all game? Is that what it is?
He played 11 men the entire game. They, out of a roster of 17, the term Iron Man had come to refer to a footballer who played a full 60 minutes of the game. Portsmouth being an old iron and steel manufacturing, blah, blah, blah. Players were already being described, were not unusual in the NFL before the 1940s, et cetera, et cetera. Spartans were known wide as near as the 17 Iron Man because they have urged to the top with only 6 men available for substitutions. But yes, they play this entire game with 11 men. They win 19-0. They get revenge for the not only for week one of the season in Green Bay, but also for Green Bay refusing to play them the year before. It's also interesting because the Packers have a lot of complaints about the behavior of the fans in this game. I want to see if I can find some exact quotes here, but basically they say that the fans are Kelly insisted another factor which must be taken into consideration is the attitude taken by the spectators. In all my connection with professional football, I have never seen a crowd so unsportsmanlike and insulting as that crowd at Portsmouth. Clark Hinkle, the Packer fullback, recalled that the mood of the crowd was ugly. When we got off the team bus, they threw oranges and eggs at us, which in 1932 was a big sacrifice to make. From the moment the Packers arrived on the field until the time they left, they were subjected to a barrage of epithets and a collection of abuse, which would have taken the heart out of any team. And just because I'm quoting from this pretty definitive or pretty extensively, this is an article. I got it on Shawnee State University's Historical Society. It's written by Derek Parker and Andrew Fate. And I have no idea how long ago it was written, but it's a good article. So I wanted to at least cite my work.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you send me the links, I can put it in the show notes. So they're looking at the Bears and the Spartans. And even though the Bears only have six ties and the Spartans have four, they are statistically tied at 6-1. Plus, they tied each other in each of their two games. They tied once 13-13, and they tied another time 7-7. I believe what I'm reading here is that when they played when they tied at 13, Red Grange had been hurt. But they end up tied, and so they decide that the only way to settle this is to establish I should also note here, after the Packers lose the title, they instead go to Hawaii and they play a series of exhibition games, two exhibition games against the University of Hawaii on Christmas and then against a team of Island All-Stars on New Year's Day. So they're things are working out pretty well for them. But meanwhile, back in the cold weather, it was agreed that the Spartans and the Bears would meet in Chicago on December 18th at Wrigley Field. It would be counted as a regular season game for both teams. So it's basically kind of like they used to do in baseball, where it would be a one game playoff, but it would count as part of the season. So technically speaking, what got you the higher record was not the fact that you beat that team, but that with you winning and them losing, you now had a higher regular season winning percentage.
Now, honest question, if they had tied again, what would they have done?
I mean, what would they have done in 1932? Probably just nothing. They probably would have just... Now, the question becomes... Yeah, because the ties don't even count. So it's not like the Packers would have been able to to slide in there.
Yeah, I didn't. That didn't occur to me until just now. But yeah, you're right. It would have just been a stalemate. But so I don't know how much you want to talk about either of these teams. I think the Bears are probably more interesting. I mentioned Potsy Clark, the coach of the Portsmouth team, name that sticks the most out of me is Dutch Clark, who was the lead rusher for them. And they also had Glenn Presnell. I'm assuming I'm pronouncing that right. But, what do you know about the 1932 Portsmouth Spartans that you can enlighten me on?
So Potsy Clark is the coach, and we'll talk about him a little bit.
I have a feeling we won't be talking to him. He lived longer than you would have thought, though. He lived until 1972.
That's not surprising. It's like 40 years late.
Was the same year. There's the same year they changed the rule about ties counting in the standings. Maybe that's for him.
Dutch Clark is their best player. He is a Hall of Famer who is six-time All-Pro running back and defensive back. perhaps best known, I don't know what year this is that he does this, but I can look it up. He still has, I think he still has a piece of the record. No, I'm sorry. That's Ernie Nevers I'm thinking of, not Dutch Clark. Dutch Clark, who is in his final year with the Spartans. I don't know why he doesn't play in 33, but then he rejoins the Spartans when they become the Detroit Lions. Clark plays 7 years in the NFL. He's an all-pro in the first six of them. He leads the league in touchdowns a couple of times. Like I said, he's actually a first ballot Hall of Famer. I think he was elected to the Hall of Fame right when the Hall of Fame was established in 1963. But he is unavailable for this game because he had made a commitment immediately after the season ended to begin a job as the, I believe it's the basketball coach. It really probably wouldn't be football. Yeah. He has got a job coaching basketball at his alma mater of Colorado College. The Spartans ask if he can be show up a week or so late so he can play in this game. Then the Colorado College says no.
And by the way, that's the reason he does not play in 1933, is he elected to serve as the head coach for the Colorado School of Mines.
Oh, that's what it was. Colorado School of Mines. Yeah, not his alma mater was Colorado College, but Colorado School of Mines is where he's coaching. Yeah.
Now, do you think they went on like silent counts all the time?
That would be mimes with an M, not mines with an N, but that's okay. Other than that, I don't really know that there's a lot to really put out there as far as their roster is concerned. No other Hall of Famers, although they do have a couple other guys who are in the on the all 1930s team and guys who would go on to star for the team when they won the championship in Detroit a couple years later. A tackle by the name of George Christensen, a right guard guy's name is Gover Connor Emerson, actually a five-time All-Pro. He's a guy you could see getting the Hall of Fame one day if they do another veterans ballot. Ox Emerson, a blocking back by the name of Father Lumpkin, who is an All-Pro. I don't know what he's an All-Pro in this season, actually, in the 1932 season. So historically speaking, even for people who are sort of football aficionados, not a ton of really well-known names other than Dutch Clark on this 32 Portsmouth Spartans team. But there's more on the Bears, and we can talk about them in a second, unless you have something on Portsmouth.
Just something kind of interesting. They played five straight road games, and actually, if you look at it, so they start their home against the Giants, then they're home against the Cardinals. They go to Green Bay on October 9th, which it said that maybe it was the Packers' first game. It obviously wasn't Portsmouth's first game. Then they must have spent a month in New York City because they played at Staten Island on October 16th, October 20th. They played the Giants on October 30th, and then they played the Dodgers on November 6th. So they must have just spent the whole month in New York City. I doubt they were going back and forth from New York to Portsmouth, Ohio every single week.
So the Bears are, you know, they are the Chicago Bears, although George Halas is actually not the coach of this team. He becomes the coach again the following year because the Great Depression is really starting to impact the Bears' business. And so Halas decides that why be paying a coach when he can just do it himself? But for this year and for the few years previous, their coach was Ralph Jones, who was sort of an offensive innovator. He had modernized the T formation, which is the formation where the quarterback is the one who is directly under the center and takes the snap compared to previously when, and I don't know if you would call this the single wing or something else, but it was basically where three or four guys would line up in the backfield and it could be snapped sometimes to either one of them. The T formation, while it has certainly undergone a lot of changes in the last 90 some odd years, is kind of the beginning of the modern NFL offense.
And Ralph Jones, by the way, also a basketball coach. He coached high school basketball in 1899. Spent some time in Butler, Purdue, Illinois. So he both of these coaches also spent time coaching basketball as well. But yeah, so Hallis had been player coach until 29. He retires after the 29 season. And, you know, I think at that point his plan was to just entirely stop with the day, you know, he's not going to play anymore. He's not going to be the coach. He's just going to have his ownership stake and can, you know, be, I guess the de facto GM, because there was no real position such as that back then. You know, that he would be sort of assuming that role. And then, like you said, a couple of years later, he would come back and coach and step, you know, he had a couple of interregnums where he stepped aside and then came back as Bears coach. But this is during his first sabbatical from coaching. And you're right, it's just one of those things where I just assumed Hallis was the coach until I looked this up and I was like, oh, wow, it wasn't him.
So talk a little bit about the Bears here. There's four Hall of Famers that I could see on the team. The starting, he's actually no longer the starting center, is a Hall of Famer named George Trafton, who is a center, but then also a middle linebacker. Remember, these are times when, you know, teams did not have free substitution. It's interesting. You think of these guys from the 30s as these sort of tough two-way players. But apparently Trafton was much better on defense than he was on offense because, and this is from Wikipedia, but I'll trust it. This is one of his teammates says the following. He was a great center on defense, but lazy as blazes on offense. Pictures of our games showed George standing with one hand on his hip after passing the ball back and just gawking around. And then another player, I guess, cures him of that. He spotted Trafton stargazing, got a flying start, and rammed George squarely in the belly with his head. It knocked him 4 yards backward and out cold. That cured him, although this next sentence leads me to believe that maybe it didn't quite cure him, because after that, he just laid down after he snapped the ball. So Trafton is in the final game of a Hall of Fame career. The second Hall of Famer is an end, a guy named Bill Hewitt, who is actually in his rookie year. Hewitt, who plays both, you know, both offensive end and defensive end. He starts as a rookie, he plays both ways. I don't know if it's even recorded. I don't believe if he has any receptions in this game. I also think there probably weren't a lot of receptions to be found. But then you also have on this team, and it's funny, growing up, I always thought these guys played together more than they actually did. But you have the two legendary Hall of Famers in the backfield, and that is the fullback Bronco Nagurski, who is in his second year in the league, this would be his third year in the league, as a 24-year-old fullback. But then you also have the great Red Grange, who is in his eighth year in the league as a halfback. Grange had signed with the Bears out of the University of Illinois in 25 and had gone on a barnstorming tour with them, famous tour. But then was out of football in 26. He was in the with the New York team in the upstart, the first American Football League. And we did an episode in that on that topic of rival football leagues. 27, after that AFL league folds, he's with the Yankees, the New York Yankees football team. I have to be honest, I don't know where he is in 28. I will look that up real quick. Let me find that real quick before we move on. Where is he in 28? It doesn't really say where he is. Maybe he's barnstorming or something in 28. He missed the entire 1928 season with an injury. Okay. And then in 29, he returns to the Bears and, you know, he has some, you know, some decent years, has an all pro year in 1931 and then 32, 33 and 34. So he's got a couple years left on the Bears, but he teams up. This is probably the year where he and Nagurski really kind of team up the most. And Nagurski, who is, you know, Granges of running back and defensive back, Nagurski, who leads the league in rushing TDs with four in 1932, is first of four all pro seasons. And Nagurski defensively is what we would kind of consider a linebacker. But both Grange and Nagurski in 1932 star in this newly established and continually updated by Coach Jones T formation of the Chicago Bears.
So the Bears have a distinction to begin this season that is unlikely to ever be matched. Their first three games all end in 0-0. They're 0-0-3. They've played all three games on the road. Come to think of it, the second and third games being on the road probably helped them because they would have needed to vacate their stadium so Babe Ruth could have called the shot.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
October 2nd, October 9th, 1932. Then actually they lose their fourth game. So they're 0-1-3. And then they don't lose again. Now they tie a few more times. They have some wins. And they finish with that with six ties, which is just insane to think about. And they tied almost half of their games is crazy to think about. This would be an interesting factoid as part of a larger episode. This was the first NFL playoff game, and it wasn't really designed to be a playoff game. And, you know, if we were doing 1932 in sports, we'd bring it up and talk about it. What makes this its own episode is what's about to come next.
Yes.
So the last week of the regular season, December 11th, the Bears are playing the Packers in presumably a must-win game because of everything that's going on in the with the Packers. And I have a Chicago Tribune article, not from then, from 2019, but that talks about this. They play the Packers in front of only 5,000 people at Wrigley Field. Remember, A, it's the Depression. B, it's December in Chicago. Only 5,000 people there. The day before, the Saturday, 4 inches of snow falls. Throughout the game, it snows. There's a wind chill's about 11 degrees. The snow and cold and ice continues for a few more days. And George Halas, remembering that in 1930 against the Cardinals, who were also in Chicago at the time, they had played an exhibition game indoors at Chicago Stadium. He starts lobbying to move the game indoors. And primarily you would imagine for attendance. They needed, you know, times were tough. They needed people there. They only got 5,000 for the Packers. A week later, in worse weather, tougher to get around. Yeah, it's a championship game, but how much does that mean to people? That's the primary motivation for them moving this game indoors. William Veeck Sr. Releases Halas from his pledge to play all home games at Wrigley Field. Presumably, this is a different enough venue. It's not like he's playing a home game at Comiskey. This is a different enough situation that presumably he's going to let him. The Spartans agree to play the game on the road, knowing that their share of the gate in Chicago would be greater than elsewhere. By Friday, December 16th, the move is official. It's in the newspaper. Howard Roberts of the Chicago Daily News writes, "Even the hardy pro-gritters, whom even last week's heavy snow could not daunt, balked at playing on an icy field in sub-zero weather and in comparative privacies." So they have announced they're playing this game indoors. A couple other things. This is instead of we'll talk about the differences in the field. Wilfred Smith of the Chicago Tribune concurred The Chicago American's game preview said indoor grid to Spurs scoring. Wilfred Smith of the Chicago Tribune wrote, touchdowns may be more frequent, which should be satisfactory to the customers. And certainly there's sufficient room for Bronco Nagurski to crack a few ribs. So the stage is set. We're going to play indoors, 1932, first NFL playoff game, de facto championship. To my knowledge, the first and only playoff game that's played in an arena. So I guess we need to now talk about the differences in the field.
Well, first of all, they're worried about whether they're going to have, they got to bring dirt in to pad the field, except they don't need to bring dirt in because the circus has just been in town. So there was 6 inches of dirt covering the concrete floor. And I'm reading here from a biography of Bronco Nagurski. Hallis is just as glad to not have to pay for it. As soon as they get out on the field, Potsy Clark catches a whiff of the animal droppings that are still permeating the field and begins to scream, "Hey, George, this place smells like horse blank. I mean, elephant blank. Didn't you guys think about raking this field?" But Hallis is trying to save money. He had given away more tickets to some regular season games than he had sold. He had yet to break the news to Nagurski and Grange that he was short on their salaries. For the second straight year, the Bears stars would be going home from the offseason with IOUs in their pockets. But maybe the Bears are no match for cheapness when it comes from the Spartans, because this is, again, from that same biography. The Spartans more than lived up to their nickname. The team was so strapped that the players were required to supply their own pants, socks, and shoes. One of their best players could not afford socks, so he wrapped his feet in adhesive tape provided by the team. When the paychecks were handed out every morning, players raced each other to the bank to make sure that their paychecks would clear, because half of the checks were always guaranteed to bounce. I feel like when we talked about the World Football League in the 70s, I think there was a couple teams that had the same, same thing. And Potsy Clark would tell his team to keep their shoes handy when the team was traveling by bus, because if he spotted open land alongside the road, he would order the bus driver to stop for a quick practice. So teams are really doing it on a shoestring here. The field. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the field?
Couple things, yeah. So Marvin McCarthy in the Chicago Daily Times 2 days after the game said the Bears and Spartans had quite an evening of it, prospecting in the soil strewn out for them by the stadium red shirts. McCarthy explained how the stadium kept its own supply of dirt and repeatedly reused it as a cost-saving measure. Over time, the soil collected an aggregation of sticks, cigar butts, and an occasional elephant tusk tip, then and whatever the circus animals dropped out of their hind ends. So this article is from 2019, and they actually talked to Virginia McCaskey, who I believe has passed on since then. But
Hallis's daughter.
Hallis's daughter, and she remembered it. You know, she was alive during that. And they asked her almost 9 decades later. McCaskey didn't hesitate when asked about her lasting memory of the Bears' 9-0 victory. Just the odor, she said.
I was just about to say, she probably remembered the smell.
It was almost overwhelming because the circus had just left town. So here's the situation with the field, and I have it in my notes, but I want to read from the article as well, just so I get it right. So the field, it's covered in tan bark covered field itself. 80 yards long, but that's 80 yards total. So it's 60.
And let me just break in there, because I just realized this when I did the research for this the other night. I had always seen 80 yard field, and I had thought they meant 80 yards versus 100. No, it's 80 yards counting the end zones, 60 and then 10 on either side. Now, I would ask why they didn't make the end zones 5 yards, especially because nobody's really throwing the ball. It's, you know, they probably could have gotten away with 5 yard end zones in a 70 yard field. But anyway,
80 yards, 60 yards between the goal lines, and 45 yards wide, 10 yards narrower than the regulation width at the time. Now it would be 8 yards because it's 53 yards. Goalposts were moved back from the end lines to the goal lines, which was then made permanent in 1933, stayed that way until 1974, and is now back at the end line where it's been ever since.
Yeah, it's funny. If you watch games from the 50s and 60s, you see that the field goal posts are right on the goal line, and they were the old H-shaped posts rather than the what we have now. It's always been interesting to me because they probably did it because the field goals were getting too easy, but how did people not realize that was just a tremendous safety issue? Not to mention just a pace of play issue. You're trying to run a goal line play and you got two big bars in the goal middle of the field.
So the couple other things, every time a team crosses the 10-yard line, which I believe means the opponent's 10-yard line, the ball was moved back 20 yards.
I have that down as midfield, not the 10-yard line.
Okay. I'm looking at, because I see they had a quote where it was different than the way they do it. They did it in the 1930s or in the 1930 exhibition. I'm looking, I had a quote from Hallis here where he was just trying to 1930. Okay. Writers also celebrated that the ball would be spotted true to normal rules to start each possession. In the 1930 exhibition, confusion reigned when the ball was moved back 20 yards before each drive to simulate a regulation field. We think it better, Hallis said, per the Daily Times, than tangling up the customers with a lot of bosh about throwing 20 yards down at one end, about borrowing 20 yards down at one end of the field, paying it back down at the other. Whatever all of that means.
But they moved them back 20 yards once they crossed midfield is the upshot of it. Yeah.
And then the final thing, the final couple of differences, they moved the goal line, but they also decided that due to smaller field and indoor stadium, drop kicks and field goals would not be used in the game. So kind of makes you wonder why they bothered with goalposts at all.
I think they did kick an extra point.
That was my guess. And then the biggest thing that, like, to the modern eye, for the first time, all plays started with the ball on or between the hash marks, which were 10 yards from the sideline.
Yeah, it used to be if you went out of bounds, they would basically just put the ball, like, right next to the sideline.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's hard to think of something that's less, that would be, of all of those, the thing that would be the most jarring if you watched that game with the modern eye would be that.
And I thought I saw somewhere, though I can't see it right now, I thought I saw that they also only actually used one end zone.
That maybe is possible. There's a history of that. They did that at Wrigley Field like 15 years ago.
Yeah, in a bowl game.
Mm-hmm. So that sort of sets the stage. The other thing that I thought was interesting was because of where it was, they were able to play this game at 8:15 at night.
That's a good point.
Think about how long it probably was before there was an NFL championship game, Super Bowl, whatever, at that time of night.
It's a good point. Even now it doesn't start that late.
It was 60 years almost until Chicago played an outdoor baseball game. night baseball game. So it's an 8:15 kickoff.
Quick on the field goals. I also thought I saw that the field goal was actually less about the size of the field and more because they thought it wouldn't be fair to let teams kick field goals inside when they didn't have to deal with the wind. I thought I saw that somewhere too.
That's interesting. So let's just talk real quick about the Chicago Stadium, which would be the stadium in Chicago until 1995. They called it the Madhouse on Madison. Would eventually be probably most famous for being the home of the Chicago Bulls during their first three-peat. It also was the home of the Chicago Blackhawks. At this point, the Bulls did not exist. The Chicago Blackhawks did exist. Do you know what the most interesting thing about 1932 in Chicago Stadium was, in addition to hosting an NFL championship game, do you know what else they hosted?
I think they hosted both the Republican and the Democratic conventions, right?
They hosted both conventions.
I was just going to make a joke about how one of the things you remember about Chicago Stadium is I think he was already retired, but Mike, for the first time, Michael Jordan came back and played an exhibition there in like the last ever basketball game at Chicago Stadium, and then got down and kissed the court as he was leaving. I wonder if he had known just how much animal crap there had once been, if he still would have kissed the court.
That's a good point. It also, I was looking at boxing. They didn't have a ton of boxing. Marciano beat Jersey Joe Walcott in 1953. Sugar Ray Robinson against Jake LaMotta in 1951. Rocky Graziano against Tony Zale in 1947.
Rocky Marciano?
That one was Graziano. Excuse me.
You can't talk about one
talking about the other. Yeah. They did end up having a lot of concerts. Not as much wrestling as you would think for an old timey building, but whatever. But yeah, so that's the building. It's a new building. It's only been open since 1929 at this point. It's about to host an NFL championship game. Probably the only building that's hosted an NFL, NBA, and NHL championship game.
And political conventions.
Yeah, well.
So maybe we should get a little bit to the on the field game. I would note that, and keep in mind here that George Halas is not the coach, but he's still yelling at Potsy Clark across the field. He says to him, "Where's Dutch?" That being Dutch Clark, his star. Potsy Clark says, "Ain't here, and it's none of your goddamned business." Halas then says, "Just wondering, you know, it's a good idea to have your best player around for big games." And Clark says, "Don't worry, George, we got enough fellas to kick your dead ass." So they don't. Go ahead.
Real quick, the game is broadcast in Chicago on WBBM radio, courtesy of Charles Denby 5-Cent Cigars. And in Portsmouth, a man named LT Henderson read a play-by-play account to people inside Selby Auditorium downtown. Descriptions were wired from the stadium to Henderson via Western Union.
Which it's funny because you got to think that might have been one of the first times they did that with football. That was always a baseball thing going back to, you know, the teens, you know, the Black Sox era. And you wonder if that's one of the first times they did that with football.
Yeah, you're probably right. I also have a note here that at one point a punt hit the organist.
I saw that too. I also saw that it like knocked out a couple of letters of another punt knocked out the letters of a Blackhawks sign.
Yeah.
So we don't necessarily have to spend a ton of time on the game. There is no scoring in the first quarter. There is no scoring in the second quarter. There is no scoring in the third quarter. Although I would note that some of the analysis that I saw said that perhaps had Portsmouth had a couple of drives where had they been able to kick a field goal, they may have done so. But since field goals were outlawed, they had to go for it. Ended up with nothing. The only scoring of the game comes on a pass, or the only touchdown of the game, I should say, comes on a pass between the two legends, a Nagurski pass to Grange. The rules at the time, and this is actually not related to this game specifically, but the rules of the time held that you had to be 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage to make a pass, to make a forward pass. Nagurski passes it to Grange. Grange scores. You know, Grange is in the end zone. He scores the touchdown. Potsy Clark and the rest of the Spartans protest and say that he had not been 5 yards behind the line. But the play stands. A little bit later, the Bears get a safety against the Portsmouth Spartans to make the final score 9-0 and bring home the first ever NFL title for the Chicago, first ever NFL title game for the Chicago Bears.
Yeah. It says the next morning, Chicago's newspapers, and I'll send you this article too, it's from the Tribune. The next morning, Chicago's newspapers and major out-of-town publications, such as the New York Times, told the Bears' first championship, even though it wasn't in 11 years, even though it wasn't front page news. Front page of the Tribune screamed about a potential $10 billion loss for the United States involving wartime loans to European countries. In the New York Times, the account of the NFL championship game competed for space with stories about racquetball, squash, and fencing. The legacy of the game as a curiosity, as a sort of footnote, is interesting. But then there was also the rule changes and things like that that came out of this. That was it directly because of this game? Who knows? But a lot of this stuff was introduced in this game, such as the passing would be permitted anywhere behind the line of scrimmage instead of 5 yards back. Potsy Clark was instrumental in this because apparently he said Nagurski will pass from anywhere anyway, so why not make it legal? A year later,
I want to learn more about Potsy Clark because he just seems like the best kind of like early 20th century just jackass to everybody.
And then it says in 1934 they shrunk the ball to encourage passing. The hash mark rule was established to make it more towards the center of the field, the goalposts we talked about. And then obviously in 1933, the NFL championship game, not as a result of a quirk in the schedule, not as a result of, you know, anything other than it being a standard thing, becomes the common practice. The NFL championship game, 1933, the Bears, this time in their normal home of Wrigley Field, beat the Giants 23-21 in front of 26,000 people.
Apparently the guy who'd really been pushing for that among sort of the leadership of the early league was George Preston Marshall, the owner of the Redskins. And they do for the following year, they go to two divisions and a championship game, you know, a scheduled championship game. Like you said, the Bears beat the Giants 23-21. I don't know when they start to standardize the scheduling, because I'm looking at, you know, 33, 34, you still got teams playing 13, 11. And well, in 34, you had a couple teams, the St. Louis Gunners, who I believe only lasted for those three games in 1934. So I don't know when it fully standardized, and maybe teams going defunct mid-season in the midst of the Depression was a part of that. I think by 1935, everybody is basically at 12. You got a couple teams that only play 11. Maybe they were supposed to play each other, and there was some sort of a reason why they didn't. But okay, it's not that many years more until things are standardized. And then it looks like, okay, by 36, everybody is playing 12 games, and I'd imagine it stays that way for the rest of the time. So, you know, at some point around this time frame, teams lose control of their own scheduling for good, and you are told that you have to play a set schedule, which is really kind of the sign of a grown-up league. So yeah, beyond just it being the first championship game, this is kind of the harbinger of a lot of things in the future of the NFL.
Well, and I think if you look in 33, so that Staten Island team is gone. Three new teams come in, the Cincinnati Reds, who don't last long, but then the Philadelphia Eagles and the Pittsburgh Pirates, who would become the Steelers shortly after that. So, you know, two sort of legacy teams. The following year, that Portsmouth team moves to Detroit, becomes the Lions. So by even 1934, you've got the New York Giants, the Boston Redskins, the Brooklyn Dodgers, the Philadelphia Eagles, Pittsburgh Pirates, Bears, Lions, Packers, Cardinals. Like, the league is starting to look like what the league would look like through the 40s and 50s. You know, the most of the tentpole franchises are in existence by then.
Just a preview, I'd like to at some point do an episode about that like 34, 35-ish time period in Detroit sports, because you had the Lions winning, you had the Tigers back-to-back World Series, you had the Red Wings winning the Stanley Cup, and then you also had Joe Louis. And in fact,
that's a good point.
I think there was a night of champions that they did one night, like a dinner that they were all at, including Louis. And just before we wrap up, just hold on one second, okay?
Sure.
So I have this book that I probably hadn't actually looked in about 30 years or about 30 years. I got it. I think I got it at that Bookworm used bookstore in Poughkeepsie once upon a time. And I thought I remembered Potsy Clark wrote a poem that he would distribute regularly to his players. You strive until the goal is gained, then look for one still unattained. Your record points the course you take to greater records you can make. For hope springs not from what you've done, but from the work you've just begun. So a little less profane there than he was yelling at George Halas across Chicago Stadium in 1932. But wanted to give a full measure of the legacy of Potsy Clark.
Coached basketball, he coached football, and he wrote poetry. A true Renaissance man.
Exactly. Well, this was fun. I'm glad that we did this. This was a cool episode.
Yeah, and although our usual behavior doesn't illustrate it, not everything needs to be 2.5 hours long. So,
yeah, no, exactly. So it's it's kind of a good and there's a lot of good articles, books, different things out there if you want to learn more about this this era in professional football. And I'm sure we'll do more as the years go on too. So this was good. Hope you all enjoyed it. And next time you'll know that there was once a football game played on a 60-yard field in Chicago Stadium that had very recently been covered in animal waste. So lots of fun for all.
Yes.
Well, we will catch you next time with something probably completely different, but we'd like to thank you for listening. And until then, I'm Dan Newman.
And I'm Andrew Newman. Goodbye, old sports.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.